We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Five Star App Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host, Ariel Garten, one of the founders of brain sensing headband, Muse. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation, mindfulness, and brain-focused practices have the power to change our lives. Whether you're just learning to meditate or want to deepen your practice, Meditation Studio, with hundreds of guided meditations, and Muse, which gives you real-time feedback on your mind during meditation, and Muse 2, which also tracks your breath, your heart, and your body, are tools you'll definitely want to have in your back pocket. Now, here's this week's episode with Ariel.
Hello, and welcome to another wonderful episode of Untangle. Today, my guest is Dr. Manpreet Singh. She's the Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, and she directs the Pediatric Mood Disorders Program. She's here to teach us about resilience and to help us understand at any age, whether we're youths moving into a time when we could be vulnerable for a psychiatric disease or we're adults trying to live the best life we can, how at any age we can use different practices to enhance and enable our resilience. She'll also teach us some of the new theories behind what resilience might look like in the brain and how neuroscience might direct us to new ideas and opportunities in this space. Was that accurate?
Perfect.
Great. Welcome, Manpreet.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Wonderful to have you. And I have to start off by asking about your beautiful name, Manpreet. What does that mean?
Well, it comes from the origins of Gurmukhi, which is a North Indian religious scriptural language that breaks down to Man and Preet. Man means mind and Preet means love. So the essential meaning of this name is really love of your essential self. It's a name that was given to me by my parents as a gift to remind me to journey in life, self-realizing and continuing to work and travel through life, reminding myself of my essential self, but also loving my essential self. So though it's not something that's a fixed trait, self-realization requires continual self-evaluation and improvement. It's certainly an inspiration to me, and I'm grateful for that gift from my parents.
I just have to ask, how did the awareness of your name evolve? Because when you're little, you know, being named Mind Love means one thing, and then as you grow into a teenager and into an adult, obviously doing such deep work in this space, it takes on a whole new context.
It really does. And I think that's the beauty and potential of language, where you can interpret it throughout your life in the context of your experiences. So my parents taught me the language of Gurmukhi, the Sikh scriptural language, early in life so that I could have the tools to be able to understand its literal meaning and then be able to apply it to my daily life. So I use it as a way to continue to not just understand the literal language, but it's a very poetic language and meant to be inspirational. Over time, you begin to appreciate its deeper value. For sure, I would say that my name has evolved in terms of meaning for me throughout my life, because that was just the introduction to a much, much larger engagement with the philosophical principles that underlie Mind Love.
Well, it sounds like your parents really set you up for success and resilience. And I know your early experience in your family really taught you a very immediate experience of resilience with your sister. Can you tell us about that a little bit?
I sure can. My sister was born in 1980, around the same time, actually several months after my family immigrated to North America, first to Canada, and then we moved later on to the U.S. From India. And I was three at the time, and my sister was born in early 80s in Canada. The resources were very limited in terms of care for kids that might have special needs. And my sister was born with Down syndrome. And at the time, the doctor's prognosis for my sister wasn't very positive. It suggested that my sister might not live very long, and that because she had some complicated heart conditions, she would die fairly soon after birth. She waited 3 years to receive an important surgical intervention to try to repair a heart defect that is commonly associated with Down syndrome. And by that time, her lungs had become so weak that she wouldn't survive that surgery if it was prolonged. So they did part of the procedure. They did a procedure that was important for life-saving procedure to keep her at least alive and her lungs functioning. But the hole that she had in her heart remained open and unrepaired. Mm. And that wasn't a particularly uncommon thing for kids with Down syndrome in that early stage of exploration of this problem in science and in medicine. Though I think the bigger challenge for my family was to manage the rather bleak prognosis that was presented to us. And it wasn't just once, it was several times through her early life when we heard with pretty regular frequency that my sister was going to die. And that was hard.
That you were like five.
I was four, five, six, and I would continue to hear that be prepared. And my parents weren't very doom and gloom. They would sort of absorb this information and take it into context. They had, I think, a strong belief system of a higher power that was probably in play from their perspective. And that helped them cope. But what was curious to me was the prognosis just was so consistent. And though I know the practitioners and the specialists were doing what they needed to do to ensure that we had some understanding of her condition and its trajectory, there was still a hint of unknown. And that hint of an unknown is what became my passion. Because as I grew up, I became very enamored with the idea that what we don't know should be a source of hope and inspiration for us, not a source of discomfort or anxiety. And so when I grew up, I became a doctor and I vowed that I would work with kids like her who struggled with issues that medicine didn't know much about, and that I would work to engage with both advancing knowledge so that we can go into uncharted territory in science, but also be in the business of conveying hope to families who are struggling with chronic illness. I became the hope doctor very quickly after I explained this inspiration from early childhood. And that seems apropos because of the work that I do in children suffering from depression, which is fundamentally a disorder of despair and hopelessness. Even in that context, I feel that there is hope, even in hopelessness. My desire to engage with this career in such a way was entirely inspired by my parents and my family's process, both of grieving that my sister might have many, many challenges ahead, but also recognizing the potential innate capacity for her to be resilient. In fact, she is 39 this year and thriving. She beat all the odds. She's not even oxygen dependent for her failing heart or needing medications chronically, except for mild associated conditions related to Down syndrome, but lives a very functional, rich life and has inspired my family to imagine that even when you don't do much and have a hope and continue to engage with a subspecialist to make sure that that the medical needs are met, there's always room for hope.
Oh my God. Your sister survived, is 39 and thriving, and doesn't even need medication for her heart or her lungs.
That's right. Right. So we didn't expect this. And when I was 20 and in my 20s and training in medicine, it was the first time in my life when I had heard a cardiologist say to me that my sister might actually be alive to see my children, which was unfathomable.
I'm going to cry.
It was unfathomable to me. It was really touching and you know, pun intended, heartwarming, because this is a child who grew up with cards stacked against her, and she beat it. She beat them all, and it's what I see time and time again in many, many individuals around the world who are struggling and still find a way to engage with hope.
So that led you to study resilience.
It certainly inspired my path towards this.
So when I've previously seen you talk about your work, you've talked about 10 different tools that people can use for resilience, which we're going to dive into today. Can you give us just a little overview of what some of those tools are, and then later we can dive into the details on them?
So I think that the building on the science of resilience is an intriguing solution to a number of breakthroughs that we need to make in order to translate medicine to meet clinical unmet needs of all sorts of patients from all walks of life. We need better tools to help us detect disease conditions early on, biomarkers, if you will. We need preemptive interventions for people who are at risk or in pre-symptomatic stages of illnesses. And we need better treatments for people living with serious chronic conditions like depression that not only predict outcomes, but can track them over time so that we know not only what is tracking towards more vulnerability, but also what's tracking towards success and adaptation. So we generally define resilience as a complex and dynamic process. It's, you know, broadly defined as the ability to adapt successfully to adversity, stressful life events, significant threat, or trauma. And it tends to be on a continuum because it can be cultivated. And with tremendous potential for change across the lifespan. One of the key factors that my sister's physicians relayed to my family in my 20s, when I finally heard that she might live to be,
an aunt.
An aunt, exactly, was that it was our family's own resilience that contributed to my sister's survival. That one of the reasons she was alive today was because of the love that my family conveyed to her, and the not giving up, the belief that she would do just fine, and that she had her own intrinsic capacities for adaptation. And so this became of great interest to me, and I studied and researched wherever I could, what are the biological aspects of adaptation? What are the biological aspects of resilience? If it's a dynamic process, have we been able to study it over time? What do we understand to be not just important for the basis of resilience in humans, but is there something in nature more broadly that can help us understand this? And I came across work done by scientists at Mount Sinai. Dr. Eric Nessler, just in September, published with his team in Nature Neuroscience a very interesting study in animals, where he used a gene co-expression analysis of RNA sequencing data from the brains of mice. And what he did with these mice is they exposed these mice to a social defeat experiment that is a social stress paradigm to identify a gene network that potentially is unique to resilience. And what the team discovered is that there's this zinc finger-like protein, ZFP189, and it encodes for a previously unstudied zinc finger protein, and it apparently is the highest-ranked key driver gene in the network. Overexpression of ZFP189 in the region of the brain that regulates so many cognitive functions and emotion, the prefrontal cortex, when overexpression of this gene in prefrontal cortical neurons is observed in these animals, it preferentially activates the network in the brain that promotes behavioral resilience.
Whoa!
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Okay, hold on. So just backing up for the layman. So there is a gene, ZFP, that when it's overexpressed, i.e. you're going to get a lot of the protein that it creates. When you see a lot of that protein in the prefrontal cortex, you're going to see an increase in resilience in the animal.
In the animal, when exposed to social defeat stress. That's right. And what was curious to me was a couple of things. The fact that this was previously unstudied reinforced to me that we have some work to do, and we really don't know a lot about what's adaptive, and can we learn more about what's adaptive in our efforts to develop better treatments for people who are more vulnerable.
Just to dig in, do we know what it is that causes increased expression of this gene?
What their finding suggests is that when you overexpress this gene and the protein for this particular protein, the in a very selective region of the brain that's really important for regulation, you could begin to see evidence of behavioral resilience to social defeat stress. The second thing that was super interesting to me was that when we are oriented around understanding resilience, we seem to be very focused on social interactions. And this becomes important when we talk about the other work that folks at Mount Sinai are doing that talk about the 10 steps towards resilience, because one of those steps relates to prosociality, the importance of engaging in social interactions. And the fact that Dr. Nessler and his team used a social paradigm to understand resilience speaks to me the importance, again, of what my sister's physicians told me about why my sister is alive today. It's the family love, mind love, family love, social love that in fact has been critical to my sister's survival. And it's the social interactions that we have day to day that may be a very important clue to promoting resilience, not just in individuals, but in families, in societies, in communities around the world. And if we can engage with that broader vision of supporting behavioral resilience through reinforcement of social interactions that are positive, then perhaps we might help our more vulnerable folks be more resilient, even in the face of significant life-threatening stress.
When we are able to provide a better social environment, whether it's for a stranger or a loved one, we have the potential of encouraging their resilience. And it sounds like these mechanisms of resilience, like when we talk about what is it that is actually happening in the mind or body when you improve resilience, is this epigenetic? Is it that some increase in some factor then turns on a gene, which then increases protein, which then, you know, shifts your body in one way or the other?
That's exactly what we need to study and more and understand. So those pathways, the way that you delineated that very nicely, also calls out the important work that many scientists are doing in epigenetics that have now demonstrated very clearly the environmental impact of stress and the potential to actually induce brain plasticity towards adaptation rather than stress by creating a more nurturing environment.
So growing up in, not just growing up in an environment that's nurturing and loving, but also just existing in an environment that's nurturing and loving can literally potentially change your genes and change the way your brain is working.
Exactly. That's what we need to study more and potentially demonstrate.
Specific neuroscience aside, there are 10 behavioral things that we can all do to improve our resilience. Can we go into those?
So the first step is to keep a positive attitude. Keeping a positive attitude allows us to engage with the brighter side of things. Being optimistic is something that, you know, we kind of mock in some ways. It feels like a cliche, Pollyanna sunshine. But fundamentally, keeping a positive attitude, seeing the world through the lens of the glass being half full, can promote resilience.
Always look on the bright side.
That's right. And whatever stimulates that positive attitude, whether it's music, a nice ditty like you described, or anything else that promotes a positive attitude, a reframe by a friend or a therapist or a coworker or a boss can be extremely helpful, particularly to contextualize a struggle. We are destined to fail. I don't know if you've read Catherine.
From the lady who, from the Hope Doctor, we are destined to fail.
That's right. We are destined to fail. Catherine Schultz wrote a beautiful book about being wrong. And it summarizes, in my view, an important principle that, you know, we're so enamored in life about being right all the time, but we're much more frequently wrong than we are right. And it's in our wrong and it's in our error that we learn and grow. That's why I love science, because it has an abiding faith in being wrong. We iterate towards better. We don't have an absolute answer to anything. And we have far more questions than we have answers. And we have far less evidence than we think we do. And yet we're so enamored with being right. But if we keep a positive attitude towards even our failures, perhaps we can promote our own internal resilience.
Yeah, I just did an exercise with one of my therapists earlier today, where I went through any area of my body that had pain. I asked what its emotional experience was, and then I held it lovingly and acceptingly through its pain and through whatever it wanted to share with me. And the purpose of this slightly contrived but really beautiful and effective exercise was just that. It was to look at all of the places where the bad and the potentially wrong sits and accept it fullingly and unconditionally.
Perfect. That's exactly right. And I think that illustrates this point beautifully. The next one is reframe stressful thoughts. And it kind of builds on what we just talked about. So I don't know that we need to spend too much time elaborating on this one, but the idea that you could actually reframe a stressful thought towards something that is an opportunity to learn and to grow, and to utilize stress not as a signal to avoid, but to approach through learning, could be very helpful in building resilience.
People are now talking about things like toxic positivity, the dangers of just seeing the world in this Pollyanna way. But what you're suggesting is that as we have a positive opportunity, accepting the failures and not ignoring them, but accepting them and reframing them, and reframing difficult or stressful thoughts towards something that is more positive or, I guess, productive, something that will move you forward in some way, we are actually becoming more resilient, and we are encouraging our bodies and our minds to actually work in healthier ways.
That's right. That's right. The next prescription, if you will, for resilience is to develop your moral compass.
Ooh, what does that mean in this context?
Sometimes it takes, Manpreet, or some sort of a foundational concept or moral compass that drives us to engage with our work in fulfilling ways. It's through fulfillment that we live and engage in our work successfully. But when we have something that drives us towards that passion, then that moral compass can be a very important key driver towards adaptation, particularly around challenges. Back in the day, when I was an early child psychiatrist, I would say things like to kids, I would ask them, what do they want to be when they grow up? Like if they're 7 or 8 or 9, hard to talk about what you're going to do when you grow up many, many years later. What was seen to me a much more valuable way of engaging in the question of what do kids dream about? What do they fantasize about their best selves? Was a question that really was centered around moral compass. I reframed the question of what do you want to be when you grow up to? What problems would you like to solve?
Ooh.
And all of a sudden, we went from doctor, engineer, lawyer to I want to help climate change. I want to slow climate change. I want to help address the problem of homelessness, right? You can ask a child, what do you think it's going to take? And depending on their developmental stage, they might have very insightful responses. And it's absolutely developmentally contextualized. But kids develop a moral compass very early. Why don't we then incorporate that into our capacity to adapt? Why isn't a higher moral compass driving what we do? Perhaps it could be if it's reframed towards that. And perhaps because we're inherently social beings, we can utilize our moral compass in an adaptive way.
So we have positive outlook. We have reframed stressful thoughts, develop moral compass. What's number four?
Find a resilient role model.
Any of you who have listened to the previous podcast with Todd Herman on alter ego can understand how a role model or somebody who is modeling behavior can help you shift the way that you exist in the world.
when we find resilient role models, people who we see who have thrived through failures and successes, who have found ways to adapt to stress, their learning can become our learning.
That's really interesting. I mean, the first role model that comes to mind for me is your sister, but I'm unlikely to be able to call her every time that I'm in a difficult time. But it's very much the way that we often utilize relationships with older siblings, or in my case, my grandmother. When things went wrong, I would call her because she was clearly wise and she got through wars. Like she knows how to deal with life, and it's like no big deal to her now.
The next one is face your fears. And this next prescription, facing your fears, illustrates a point I had described earlier as well, that we are inevitably exposed not just to failure, but to stress. It's not something that's imagined or a potential. It's an inevitability. And in human life, we must find ways to confront and face our fears. Avoiding them may predispose us to other problems. And so when you have the capacity to face your fears, even the most trivial, if you perceive, that can be a building block for learning and addressing broader and larger fears.
Yeah, this is something that I believe in so deeply. And I've been doing this practice in my life where anytime I find a fear, no matter how small, it is now my duty to go into it, to actually sit with it, to feel the fear, and to know it's simply an emotion. It rises, it falls, and it goes away. And the other night, my little kid, he's three, and he said that he was scared of the shadows on the wall. And I said, well, if we went and touched the shadows, would that make it better? And he sort of gave me a look. So I, you know, held him. I walked together with him. I said, Mommy's holding you. And I said, let's touch the shadows together. I touched my shadow. He touched his. And then I said, how does that feel? Are you still scared? And he's like, no. And so it's so easy to see when you're an adult and you have a child that sees fears, how, you know, in some ways silly those fears are, how they're only a product of the mind. And as an adult, it's so easy to get sometimes sucked into your fears because you don't have somebody sitting above you seeing how they are merely a fear. The situation's actually safe. And when you approach it, you can discover there's nothing more than a shadow there.
I love that you did that with your child. When my children were 2 and 3, my daycare providers would tell me that their tantrums were just a product of evolution. It's just their amygdala reacting, and our amygdalas are evolved first before our prefrontal cortex because we need to be able to cry for help. We need to be able to seek nurturance and seek support when we're facing or confronting our fears. What we don't want to do, though, is take on those challenges completely from our children so that they don't have the capacity to learn and address their fears themselves. And so sometimes we develop habits then of avoiding confronting our fears that become then problematic for other aspects of our lives. So much of what we do in early development when we try to help kids who are confronting their fears is to really help them practice and rehearse and expose themselves to their fears. It's called exposure therapy. You can look it up, and this is a thing.
Works at any age. I've done it as an adult.
Right, exactly. This is universally a strategy.
So for adults listening, let's maybe talk about a methodology that could help an adult face their fears.
Social interactions are very common fears that adults face on a day-to-day basis. And so we find ourselves looking for opportunities to master the skill of being able to approach social inhibitions that we might have. And so rather than confront it directly, if that feels challenging to do, we practice. We do a role play with someone who's much easier to speak with. And maybe rehearse what we might want to say to the person that intimidates us. And that rehearsal allows someone to maybe fumble through and decide, hey, I'm not so excited about doing this, but I've had a chance to master how I want to approach it. And if I iterate and refine what I want to say, I might feel a little bit less intimidated. And that process, through practice, can reduce fear and enable an interaction that is more adaptive and easier than it would have been to begin with.
Another practice I love to do is to remember that fear is just a sensation. So it seems super scary to do that thing or talk to that person, but it's just a feeling that you're having. When you do the thing or talk to the person, the outcome, you know, likely will be fine. And if you just move yourself through the fear, you might have some sensation of fear. It'll rise, it'll fall. It's just what fear does. But it shouldn't actually keep you from the ultimate activity, because so often fear keeps us from doing the thing that we want to do.
The next is to develop active coping skills. So this builds on our discussion because it's describing what strategies we might use to face our fears. Because if you don't have a strategy, facing those fears can be very difficult. So developing coping strategies actively, whether it's humor or distraction or rehearsal, all of these coping strategies make it possible for us to work through fundamental stress.
Strategies like music or reframing stressful thoughts or having a methodology to face your fears or calling a buddy. In many ways, the initial five are actually different strategies that can be referred to in this
one. You bet. And this is a nice way to kind of demarcate that as we're going along this progression of prescriptions, you can imagine that these are all just building on one another. And in my view, they do ultimately kind of represent a core construct of how we build resilience, where they're commonplace, they're not news to anyone, but the practice of them, the intention around engaging with them on a day-to-day basis, in my view, is what is the secret to building resilience. The next strategy is to establish and nurture a supportive social network. This is different than finding a resilient role model, right? Because the resilient role model represents someone in your mind, an archetype, who has been successful at mastery of stressful events in their lives or overcoming challenges. When you establish and nurture a supportive social network, this social network isn't just your resilient role model. There's a network of folks that are going to facilitate your success, your resilience, but also nurture you. So I love that this next, you know, prescription says, don't just make friends, but keep friends, nurture. And this also is fundamental, in my view, to what is being described by Dr. Anthony Biglin, who's a prevention scientist and wrote in 2015 a book called The Nurture Effect, how the science of human behavior can improve our lives and our world. It's an amazingly inspirational book that talks about the inherently adaptive nature of being social. Supportive social networks are critical for our survival.
Okay, so having friends is not just a choice. It's not just a perk. It is essential.
It is essential to our survival.
That's a huge statement.
It's not just friendships, right? Like sometimes our friends play different roles. When we engage in social interactions, we want to have and build trusting relationships with people who we know have our back.
Okay, so in this case, you're actually taking the role of somebody who is promoting the, you know, creation and growth of supportive social networks. You're now encouraging other people for times when they are loving, supportive, et cetera.
Think about parenting. To what extent do we teach people in society how to effectively parent?
What parenting methodologies do you recommend?
The universal principles around effective parenting are also embedded in this prescription of resilience, is cultivating human beings who can keep a positive attitude and reframe their stressful thoughts, but also, you know, encouraging through nurturing and support and scaffolding the ability for our children to face their fears and develop active coping skills. So if we can actually teach these prescriptions that we're talking about, that's a great first step towards effective parenting. I also think that we have to parent around reinforcing pro-social behaviors. So we parent a lot around academic success, but how much do we parent around cultivating and promoting pro-social behaviors in our children by being kind and modeling being kind? And how do we do that in our parenting practices today? That's in my view, a great place for us to start strategizing around parenting. Dr. Biglin also talks about the importance of minimizing socially and biologically toxic conditions. He says that we must minimize coercion because it is the root of human conflict.
So, I mean, as a parent, you're often trying to get your child to do something.
That may sound counterintuitive because perhaps we're feeling like we're coercing our child to eat or to behave in such a way. But this isn't what this is talking about. Okay. We're talking about coercion in the context of things that potentially could induce human conflict, toxic conditions, coercion to force people to do things without agency. In terms of the business of parenting, the importance of monitoring and setting limits on influences and opportunities to engage in problem behaviors. You know, as a parent, we must be present and supervise and, of course, set limits and access, like to things like social media, right? It's important for us as parents to be very careful and cautious about setting limits and access. But it's also important to balance that with gradually allowing kids to manage their own free time in a safe, fun, and productive way. So what we don't want to be in the business of is helicoptering our children too much, to limit them too much at a stage when they're trying to explore what is the right balance. They need to be able to have the opportunity to develop the skills around self-management. And it's helpful in the business of being pro-social and resilient, to take a detached and playful approach to talk about people's thoughts. You know, sometimes what we do, the choices we make, aren't so adaptive. But perhaps rather than being too judgmental in the context of those conversations, it can be helpful to be equipoised, neutral, detached, and perhaps even humorous. That promotion of a mindful, flexible, and pragmatic pursuit of pro-social values is in fact the business of what we need to do when we're establishing and nurturing our supportive social network.
So this is a very loaded one. So a supportive social network doesn't merely mean keep a bunch of friends around you. It means establish and create a network of individuals who you support for supporting one another, who you see one's mind of, who you reflect back to, who you nurture in these ways that ultimately will nurture the entire network.
Exactly. And notice how it's building on itself.
So what is prescription number 8 for increased resilience?
To build resilience, it's important to prioritize physical well-being.
Exercise, exercise, exercise.
There's lots of science to support this, so I don't know that we need to belabor this point, but prioritizing physical well-being. And it doesn't say exercise specifically because there may be lots of different ways, and we may be socialized around cliches and, you know, maybe aversive towards the notion of exercise. So conceptually, anything that promotes physical well-being is useful and instructive in this particular step.
Massages, hugs, eating well, warm food.
You bet. Exactly. The next one is train your brain.
I'm all on board on this one.
And this is anchored around just the idea that your brain is a muscle. And it's not actually a muscle, but you can kind of think about it as a muscle and can be trained towards more adaptive strategies of coping with stress. And so there are lots of things that you can do to train your brain. And there's an emerging, burgeoning neuroscience literature that can provide some context for how to do this, but very critical for building resilience.
So these are skills like recontextualizing, continuing to learn, meditation.
Mindfulness, exactly, among others. But certainly, we've also discovered that the business of being pro-social and supporting pro-social behaviors in a family context also seems to change the brain. And if we can train the brain to change the brain to improve the outcome, then we have lots of potential here. And this is a space where I spend a lot of my time thinking about leveraging so that we can help promote and cultivate adaptive outcomes in childhood towards better outcomes in adulthood.
There's a study with kids in BC doing meditation in elementary school, and it demonstrated that a meditation intervention with them led to a 25% increase in pro-social behavior.
That is exactly right. The last step is play to your strengths. Try things that you know you can do and access the skills that you have first and build on them. Use those as your key drivers for approaching stress. And utilizing your strengths can promote confidence and has a rippling effect on your capacity to engage with stress.
So here we basically have a prescription, according to Mount Sinai Hospital, for resilience. And it contained: have a positive outlook, reframe stressful thoughts, 3, develop moral compass, find a resilient mentor, face your fears, employ active coping skills, establish and nurture supportive social networks, pay attention to your physical well-being, train your brain, and play to your strengths. Probably most of us do some portion of this throughout the day. How do you recommend people think about these 10 various activities and how they incorporate them easily into their lives?
I think first identifying and recognizing how you implement these in your day-to-day life is a very useful first step. Evaluate for yourself whether any of these 10 steps apply to you, and if there are deficits in your resilience toolkit in any of these 10 steps, maybe consider paying more attention to the ones that are that may need a little bit more attention. And practice. It, in my view, is not in the one and done, the magic bullet, the single shot intervention that's going to build a success. It's why I use the term build, because we're building on the science of resilience. And inherent to that concept is that resilience isn't a fixed state. It is absolutely something that we do dynamically over time. And when faced with a situation that is particularly challenging, if we have our capacity to reframe that challenge in a way that allows us to learn and grow from it, because we're fundamentally going to be wrong, and embrace and lean into that, it is conceivable that many more of us could be more resilient in our day-to-day lives, and practicing resilience could be part of a broader movement to make our society more resilient.
Well, thank you very much for giving us some insight into resilience, showing us some of the behaviors that we're probably already doing right now to increase the resilience in our own lives and didn't even realize it, and holding out the opportunity for hope that if we face adversity, we can have built the skills and capabilities, or if we are deficit in them, continue to build the skills and capabilities to allow us to be resilient to whatever challenges come before us. Thank you so much for being a guest on Untangle.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Dr. Manpreet Singh talking about what we can do to help us build our resilience. If you'd like an awesome infographic to help you track different ways to improve your resilience, you can find it on my website, arielgarten.com, arielgarten.com, as well as a long format version of this podcast packed with even more information. Also, if you're looking for tools to help you build your resilience, Muse, the brain sensing headband, can help you kickstart your meditation practice with real-time feedback on your mind and your body while you meditate. Whether you're a novice just looking to begin your practice or an expert looking for new insights, Muse actually tracks your brain and your body during your meditation to show you where your brain is at and to guide you into that state of focused attention. letting you know when you're focused and when your mind has wandered, so that you can really dial into your meditation practice. You can find out more at choosemuse.com, choosemuse.com. Patricia will be back next week with more Untangle, and until then, keep your neurons sparkling.